Welcome to the Drive Phase Podcast, the best podcast for information on issues surrounding sports business in the Caribbean. On the Drive Phase, we have discussions with sport administrators, coaches, athletes, and various stakeholders in the sporting industry and examine their contribution to sports and entrepreneurship. Here's your host, Dalton Myers.
So this week, we look at making the transition, life after sports, and here to discuss it with us is Dwayne Extall. He's a track and field analyst and former junior national representative for Jamaica. Dwayne, welcome.
Yeah, Dalton, thanks for having me. It's really a pleasure to, you know, just have a platform to talk about things like this because, you know, we really, really need it.
All right, well, let's start off then. Talk to us a little bit about your experience in track and field.
Yeah, when I started track and field, I was at primary school, so St. Francis Primary School. Big ups to them always. That's where track and field really started for me, but I didn't make the track team in high school until about second form. First form coach said, you know, you're not fast enough, so come back next year, you know. So I got cut in first form, but track and field really started in second form, class 3, class 2, class 1, you know, all the way through the system. So that's where sports started for me because I also played basketball at Woolmers for 6 years, you know, basketball and track at the same time. I had to give up basketball in my final year, and you know why, because, you know, we had a major goal of winning champs that year.
Mm-hmm. So we are champs now, which was a memorable year for the Woolmers family. Take us through that experience.
The role I played wasn't much different from anyone else on the team. We all knew what we had to do. But I go back to my first year champs in class 3. Woolmers finished third at that championship, and I missed the final by 0.01 seconds. So Kingston College would have won. San Diego got second. We got third. And I blamed myself. I was in second form. I blamed myself all the time, you know, so I should have pushed a little harder to get to the final because the guy that beat me into the final was from San Diego. Had he not been in the final, we would have been second.
Right.
You know, so for years, a lot of people don't know this, for years that was my motivation to do something big for Woolmers. So when we got the chance, 2009 it was when we realized that come 2010, we have a unit that will be good enough to win the whole thing. You know, we had to make sacrifices. I had to make sacrifices because of the importance of not just winning champs, but what it means to the young men on that team that we went to champs with 30 plus athletes going up against the 80, 60 plus athletes. And it just reminds us that whatever you decide to do, there's nothing that's impossible.
Winning that champs, we'll call it in Jamaica, which is our high school track and field championship, was really important. And then you moved on. Well, not necessarily moved on. Talk to us now about representing Jamaica at the junior level, CARIFTA, and then at the junior level overseas for Jamaica.
That championship set up what Coach Riley, who was my coach at the time, called your legacy. You know, your legacy will follow you forever. And it's not until now I still realize, or I get to realize, the impact of that one champs, because people still see me and they're like, yo, at the best race, I've come to watch a champs. And these are men who've been watching champs for the past 50 years. You know, so that set me up for just, it may not be the world-class times or the world-class accomplishments, but it shows that the team that we had as a unit, we had something special. And to carry that over into the junior level, the youth level, because my first youth competition was the CARIFTA Games 2007 in, I think it was Turks and Caicos. I ran the 400, 400 hurdles, 4x1, 4x4. I got 3 gold, 1 bronze. Jehu Gordon was in the 400 hurdles. I won that. Kirana James was in the 400. He won that. You know, and then we won both relays. But it was such a phenomenon when we got to Turks and Caicos. My very first experience, it was nothing like champs because I expected to hear a loud roar when your name was called. And when they said Dwayne Extall from Jamaica, it was like crickets. You know, I mean, the Jamaican contingent was there. Well,
they
were
making
there.
Nice.
But it was like, this is not champs. But just the joy of running with the Jamaica across my chest really set me up for a lot of success at the junior level going forward, because in that same year, I represented Jamaica at the World Youth Championship in Czech Republic.
Right.
You know, so that was really, really good for me.
That was your first, you know, outside of, say, for the Caribbean, competing for Jamaica. What was that experience like?
I was nervous. I didn't sleep. I didn't eat. I threw up almost every other day, and I was nervous when I went there because I brought a bag of crackers, two bags of crackers, and I finished them because I wouldn't eat the food. And I'd call my mother and I'd say, "Mommy, I want to come home." Like at the time they had MSN Messenger, yeah. So I talked right. to my mother and that, and I said, "Mommy, I want to come home." And we were there for a week and a half before competition started. And I cried and said, "I can't manage this. The cold, the hot, the cold." But it was in that moment that I was being prepared for what was to come in the future when I got to college. So that's another story. But in that moment, I learned, you know, that I have to adapt to my environment. I have to grow because I was the youngest on the team. You know, we had Nikhil Ashmi, Dexter Lee, who they went on to win medals at the junior level as well. Right. A lot of superstar athletes. And I was just, I feel sometimes that I was lucky to make that team, but in retrospect, I really worked hard to get there. So on that team, you had a lot of superstars on the team, and I was the youngest. You know, and that for me is a memorable championship and a not so memorable one because we had the Swedish relay and we lost it because of me. They said we lost the relay, but you know, I played my part. We got our first ever medal in the event at the World Youth Championship, so I'm proud of that. I mean, at 52, at the time was a youth record here for Jamaica, so a lot of things have happened at the youth level, at the junior level. But yes, it was my first time competing outside of the region for my country.
Transitioning now to one of the more interesting aspects of your track and field career, college level. Talk to us about that one and what was that like?
College is nothing like high school. It's a whole different ball game. And when I say different ball game, I mean it's a world apart from what you expect in high school. Mark you, I'll tell you this, the training in high school was a lot harder than it was in college.
Really?
Yeah, man, it was a shock for me because things that I was doing in college, my body was already accustomed to things like that, but the coaches, I think we weren't on the same wavelength for some parts of my season while in college, because I went to University of Alabama first for 2 years, then I transferred to Texas Tech.
Texas Tech.
Yeah, and I think it was good the first year because it was just learning the system. You know, I made it to the nationals, but after that, injuries is something I never really experienced in high school. You know, I started getting injured because there are so many distractions in college. And I say distractions, I mean you have so many things that you can be a part of that if you're not fully focused, and I will admit it, I wasn't fully focused when I got to college because there's all these bright and shiny things that you just want to reach and touch and reach and touch and reach and touch that it takes away from, you know, being an athlete. But at the same time, I still had to be on top of school. So I never really had much of a social life when I was in high school, and I didn't mind it because we were on a strict regime. In college, it's different. You're on your own. So you have access to every single thing that you can name under the sun, whether it's party, whether it's girls, whatever it is, you have access to that. As opposed to here, where your environment is controlled. So, I mean, I know I'm a disciplined person, but in that moment when I just got to college the first 2 years, I was as distracted as they come.
So you made that change from one school to another. Why was that change necessary?
At the time, I thought it was necessary because the coach I had at Alabama my first year, he left the job. We got new coaches. My sprint hurdle coach went, my four hurdle coach, he went to Texas. But I stuck around for a year at Alabama just to see if the new staff would work with me. I mean, mark you, I ran fast a couple of times, but it wasn't comfortable, for want of a better word. You know, I wasn't comfortable. I wasn't happy in the place that I was. So I really checked out, to be honest, Dalton. I checked out mentally, emotionally, even spiritually. I checked out because I felt like I wasn't getting what I deemed necessary for me to be an elite athlete. So I checked out mentally at Alabama. I got to the regionals. I competed, but I just ran just because of running. You know, and I lost the love for the sport itself in my second year. So I wanted to come home. There were offers for me to come back home, but I started on a path and a journey where I wanted to get my degree. I wanted to have that accomplishment of being the first of my family to graduate from university. So I stuck through the next 2 years when I transferred to Texas, even though things did get better in Texas.
So things got better in Texas. You managed to complete the degree program.
Yeah, and in all of that, it was tough. It was tougher in Texas, but it got better. In a sense where I was still getting hurt, but I had a group of coaches. My head coach at the time, Coach Wes Kitley, he really saw more in me outside of track and field than anything else. He would always encourage me to, you know, stay focused and finish school. Even when I was hurt, he said, you know, I won't trouble your scholarship. I'll just allow you to just do what you have to do to get it done, because he realized what my purpose was, because I lost hope a lot of times in college, especially in Texas. I had mental breakdowns. I had, you know, moments where I had to see a psychiatrist because I was so lost. Junior year, I had no idea what I wanted to do. This is my going into my final year. I knew I wanted to do stuff with the media, but I was all over the place mentally, emotionally, and to the point where I started missing classes because I was just so fatigued. And it's not a physical fatigue, it's the mental fatigue that wears on you the most. And if you're fatigued mentally, your body will just give way. So I felt like, and the psychiatrist said it, that's what was causing my injuries. I was fatigued mentally, I was fatigued emotionally. I just wasn't in a place where I really could have succeeded in my mind. Physically, I'm in the right place, high-class facilities, world-class trainers, world-class medicine. But in the space that I was mentally and emotionally, that's what prevented me from making the next step to the next level.
How much to do with pressure back home? Now you're overseas, you know that because of CHAMS, people expecting a lot from you. How much of that played on your mind while you were there?
That was never my concern. And I have to thank Coach Riley for this, because, and Coach Harley as well. While I was away, they always said to me, they'd send me messages, hey, don't worry about anything. There's life after track and field, even if you don't make it to the highest level. And I had that in the back of my mind. Coach Riley and I would talk almost every Friday. We'd sit and we'd talk over Skype or whatever it was for an hour. And he just constantly reminded me that there's life after the sport. There's life after the sport. He said that every time we ended a call, there's life after the sport. And it rung in my head all the time. So I didn't think about the pressures back home, because I know people had expectations, and it's okay for them to have expectations, but sometimes you're faced with reality and you have to accept reality because others won't accept it for you. And when others can't accept reality for you, they put added pressure. And when they put the added pressure, sometimes you will break under that pressure and it's hard to come back.
Talking about Coach Riley then, how important it is in terms of mentorship for athletes in making that transition from one level to the other?
Especially for the high school level, the collegiate level, the elite level, there are three different phases, and you need, and I won't say you need three different people, but you need three different mindsets to transition from one to the other. Not a lot of athletes can go from high school to elite. Not a lot of athletes can do that. You think about, you go back to the sport and you think about the great ones who've done it. They are super breed. You think of Usain Bolt, LeBron James, Lionel Messi, all those guys, they're elite from birth. You know, they have talent innate. You know, it's something that they were born with. But other athletes can't do the same, because like a baby sometimes, learning to walk, you crawl, you creep, start walking, you fall. It's not like Bolt and those guys in the sport, they just hit the ground running. I mean, they had hiccups here and there, but, you know, it's minor compared to those of us who aren't born with that immense amount of talent. You know, so mentorship is important, and Coach Riley, and I say this without apology, one of the best mentors I've had. Especially now, as a young adult, we don't speak as much, because, you know, he has a lot of things on his plate, but he does find time to send a message and say, hey, how's everything? You know, so a coach like Mr. Riley, he has gone through the system, high school, college. You know, he knows exactly what you need to get to the next level. So, you know, he was very encouraging. And even when I came back home to reignite my career, he was my coach, but he was the one who said to me, you know what, it's time to just call it.
All right, we're going to move to reigniting that career and now trying to make the transition to the professional level. So you returned to Jamaica.
Yeah, December 17, 2014, graduated December 13, and I left 4 days after, because
it's time to check out.
And that's a part of it. And that's what I tell people. That's how I knew I wasn't going to stay in America for far too long. I knew that wasn't the place for me. I mean, there are other issues outside of what I went through with the school, but the environment for me with the race difference, you know, it's there. People may skate away from it. They may go left, they may go right, but it's still in your face. You know, it's something I experienced while I was there. I mean, I remember one night coming from the library, I was on my way home, and the neighborhood where I lived, it's a little upscale, but because we're athletes, we're given enough money to afford, you know, living in areas like that. So I think it was 2:30 a.m. A Friday in the summer. I was going back, not summer, the spring. going back to my apartment, and some police officers stopped me because someone had called saying, you know, a black guy's walking through the community. Mm. And I was like, at the time it was cold, had on my hoodie and everything. This was before the Trayvon Martin thing. So, you know, after I got back to Jamaica and I heard about it, I said, you know, that could have been me. But the officer stopped me and said, you know, where are your papers and stuff? In my mind, I'm like, why would I need to have my passport and all these things? I had my driver's license. He said that wasn't enough. And luckily for me that night, my neighbor was walking his dog at 2:30 in the morning. He stopped and said, yeah, he lives right over there. And the officer said, are you sure? He said, yeah, man, he lives right there. And they went inside, got my stuff and came out. And that was, for me, the turning point in where I said to myself, you know what, this place isn't for me. You know, so I, after December 13, graduation, 4 days later, on a flight back home.
You return home and then you decide to take it a notch in terms of track and field to try and make it at the professional level. What was going through your mind then? And, you know, where did you want to take it? And if you didn't reach it, why?
Yeah, I wanted to represent my country at the senior level at least once. You know, I've done it at youth level, junior level. I wanted to complete that cycle of going to wherever it is to represent my country as a senior. But it never worked out. You know, I trained hard. My body just wasn't keeping up. You know, whenever I'd run fast in practice, I'd get hurt. It'd take me like 2-3 weeks to get better, run fast again, get hurt. That was a cycle I was on. And it was difficult sustaining myself because, you know, no shoe contract, no sponsors, no nothing. So I had to be working at the same time. So I was working, and my employees at the time, they allowed for me to, you know, structure my work hours so I could get to practice early. You know, I could come in early in the morning at work. So that for me was tough because going to work all day, then training, then, you know, probably 6 hours of rest, back to work, you know, and it was tough, it was hard, and I just couldn't deal with that anymore. So eventually I left the job so I could focus for probably 6-7 months on training, and things were going well, and then I kept getting hurt, and, you know, I sat down with coach and said, you know, this thing isn't working, you know, this thing isn't working out. I really wanted this, I love this thing, but if I love it this much and it's going to hurt me, it's best for me to move on. And he wasn't as willing to say, you know, let's try again. He was saying, you know what, you've done enough and you should listen to your body. There's a lot more you can offer to this country outside of track and field without actually competing, you know. So he said, you know what, Extol, just take your time. We'll sit down the next couple of weeks and we'll work out what you're going to do. And in all of that, while doing all of that, I was still, you know, trying my hands at different things, because when I was in college, I learned that you have to, as best as you can, maximize where you are, maximize your surroundings. So I tried a little bit of the analysis with track and field when I started my first meet, Eastern Championship in the stadium, and I said one word for almost the whole thing. It was probably the worst day of my life, you know, because I think it was Patrick Addison who called me and said, boss, I need to talk to you. And he said, I said amazing probably 100 times for the entire broadcast. Said, this is amazing. That is amazing. So it was that moment where I said, you know what, I need to work on this thing. But he believed in me. Ricardo Chambers, a really good friend of mine, helped me with that transition as well, because without him, and I'll be honest, I don't think I'd be right here now, in terms of not just the track and field analysis, but every single aspect of my life where I am now. I think Ricardo really played a big role, because in high school, he was a fan of me being in track and field, but we became friends outside of that. And when I came home, he said, you know what, you have to try other things. You know, he supported me in training. He said, you know what, just, it's not going to be easy. He never lied to me. And that's one thing I appreciate with my friends. They never, in my estimation at least, they don't lie to me about certain things. They just say it as it is. So Ricardo said, you know what, if you want to be elite at this thing, at this 400 hurdles, you have to be running X time. And I was nowhere near X time. So he was one who said, yo, just give up this thing. And
was that hard though, Extol? Was it hard to kind of be honest with yourself and make that final decision about retiring from track and field?
You know, what people call in this thing is the identity crisis. A lot of athletes, for years, that's all they know. You know, being a student athlete, being a professional athlete, that's all they know. And it's almost as if outside of that, you don't exist. So it's almost, in a sense, where you're faced in the mirror with your athlete life and then yourself, your actual self. So when the athlete fades away, what happens? You know, and this is the point. This is the point in life where I call the fulcrum. You know, the pivot. You know, where do you go after things are done? Because at some point, as a professional athlete, it will stop. It will have to stop one way or the other, whether it's by you retiring or by you not being able to sustain your body at the highest level. You have to find things outside of sports that you are good at, things that you love, things that get you up in the morning. So when I decided to, you know, step away from track and field in the competitive sense, I know I still love the sport. I love the sport because it saved me from a whole lot of things. It saved my life, you know. So I found ways to give back because I mentor my alma mater. You know, I help coach some of the boys when it's time, you know, championship preparations, I do that. But the analysis side as well, and I'm looking at all other aspects of track and field and sports in general where my skills can be used, you know. So it's not a matter for me. It wasn't a matter for me of an identity crisis. It was just which identity do I choose after this? Because Coach Riley said one of my biggest faults in sports is that I was just too smart. You know, he said, I think too much. I think too much about, you know, competing. I think too much about getting things right because I'm almost a perfectionist. When I say almost a perfectionist, I'm 98%. So the next 2%, it doesn't really matter to me in the moment, but maybe later down the line I'll think about it. So I didn't have an identity crisis because I figured out where I want to be and I had people around me who helped me figure out where I needed to be.
All right. So we were talking about the transition. You talked about dabbling in different things, and I know you were at Grace Kennedy's at a point. You did writing for the Gleaner, for Track Alerts.
And that's where I started the writing, by the way. Track Alerts.
Track Alerts.
Yeah, I'm really thankful for Anthony Foster. I just asked him one day, can I write something for your page? Mm. He said, yeah, man, go ahead and, you know, just give me a couple of stories. And that's when because I love writing. Ever since I was a child, I love writing. I love reading, you know, and I wrote some article for Track Alerts. And then the Gleaner called me saying, you know, I want to do some writing for me. And I was like, all right, might as well. You know, my uncle in New York, Teddy Bailey, he supports me a lot in writing because he wants me to, you know, just continue to find these things that I'm good at and get better at them. So the Grace Kennedy, the writing for Track Alerts, those two things, and people might say in the offset they're small things, but small things add up to big things. Smaller things, you put that all together, it becomes one big thing, and that's who I am now. Those two, and I don't say it a lot, but Grace Kennedy, Track Alerts really set the platform for me as to where I needed to go in my professional life.
And when you were talking earlier about a company helping you to train, was that Grace Kennedy's?
Yeah, Grace Kennedy. And I'm really thankful for the staff there. Even Mr. Don Webby, from time to time, he'd see me and he'd say, you know what, go after your dreams, and he'd be encouraging. In terms of when I stepped away from Grace Kennedy, they were helpful in my nutrition. They were helpful in just being an encouraging source. So Grace Kennedy, and I know people affiliate them with Boys and Girls Championship, but for me it's bigger than just the brand. You know, there are people down there who really care, because there are quite a few athletes now who work at Grace Kennedy and are still allowed to train, so they have that kind of pride. I'd say, Dalton, that they are supporting nation building by supporting your dreams.
And so then you mentioned Ricardo Chambers. How has that been going now in terms of the track and field analyst? You're considered as a big analyst for Television Jamaica right throughout the year.
Well, I don't know what a big analyst for, you know, but I can say, though, I'm happy with where I am because I'm able to sit with people I admired for years. Hubert Lawrence, Bruce James. When I sit in a community booth with those two gentlemen, I'm saying to myself, I'm still in awe. Even three, four years after working with them, I'm still in awe that I'm sitting with gentlemen of that esteem. You know, when Bruce opens his mouth to speak, you just have to sit and marvel. And then Hubert just closes his eyes. He goes back to 1980, tells you who finished fourth, who finished fifth, what time they ran. And I sit there and I'm like, how do people compare me to men like this? But I've come to understand that I have something unique of my own that I do, you know, so it's not hard to be as good as them. I mean, they are the best for me that I've ever seen. So I take bits and pieces from them. I take bits from Patrick Anderson here. I take bits from Hubert Lawrence, bit from Ricardo Chambers, a bit from Ed Barnes, a bit from anywhere I can. And I put it all together because the greatest compliment is someone who takes what they've learned from different masters. Because I think about two people in particular, and it's a whole different sport, but it encourages me so much. Michael Jordan, Kobe Bryant. Kobe Bryant mirrors everything Michael Jordan has done, and people call him a copycat, but he doesn't care. You know why? Because 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 championships, and he's gotten there because he's found someone who's great at what they do, and there's nothing wrong with that. And I think the misconception is that people don't want to see them like a copycat. Why not copy the greats? Why not copy the best to ever do it? And that's how I'm starting to live my life. And for the past 2 years, I find people who are at the top of their game in terms of the professional world, and I ask them questions, and I look at certain things that they do, and I have a book, I write every single thing down. I meet this person, their tendencies, the way they speak, the way they carry themselves. That's why I'm building this from me, an arsenal, that when I get into the professional world fully on my own, you know, I'll be ready for whatever comes my way.
Now, you have been able to make that transition and using experiences as an athlete. You are now a co-host for a television program on TVJ called Weekend Smile.
Yeah.
And you do TV, you do track and field analyst, and you also do your substantive work at the Central Bank.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In terms of public relations. How do you manage all of these?
Prayer.
apart from prayer.
A lot of times I feel overwhelmed, but I really do manage it through prayer. But one thing I can say, and the athletes who listen to this podcast and anyone who listens, you never stop being an athlete. You may stop competing, but the gene that is inside you that teaches you how to be competitive, that gene never goes away. So I'm able to apply the discipline I learned from being in high school and being in track and field and college to balancing my life, to carry that over to my professional life, because it teaches me, or well, it taught me at least, to find ways to make the most difficult things simple. So people say, you know, you do this on TV, you host Weekend Smile, you track and field analyst, you work down there, so you work here, so you mentor kids, you do... And someone said to me, I think you have 27 hours in a day because you're always doing something. But I do things that I'm passionate about. I do things that I love. I don't do things that I... And it's not about money for me, because the boys that I mentor down by Trenchtown, the ones I mentor at Woolmans, I have nothing to gain from that. But they have a lot to learn. And I'm investing in the future because someone invested in me. You know, I lost my dad at a very young age. I was 9 years old when my dad passed away. So I had mentors who came in and they poured a lot into my life. So now it's my time. I'm in a position to help the younger ones coming up to pour into their lives, to make them feel like they are still relevant, whether you're an athlete or not. You know, at Woolmans, I talk to every single boy that comes across and says, sir, can I talk to you? And we just sit there and we speak. You know, for me, it hasn't changed anything about who I am. You know, no matter how many things I do, I still find time to spend time with the boys, because that's where the future lies. And as far as I'm concerned, I'm young. I'm 28 years old, and I have a lot in front of me. It's a scary thing when I think about it, because a lot of people say, you know what, you are setting up yourself to be the next this or the next that. And I know people always say, don't say I'm the next this or I'm the next that. They say, yeah man, say me the next Hubert Lawrence. Me why you say that. Say me the next Prime Minister of Jamaica, my next sports minister. Say, just preach them things in my life. I'm going to preach in my life too. Because I'm tired of people saying, don't say me the next this, me the next that. Me the only one of this. No. You can say me the next big thing. Say it as much as you want, because it's when that positive reinforcement surrounds your life, the energy that comes with it, it pushes you on to great things.
Positive energy from that dreaded day of saying amazing to now also working with Sol Rixon and the Digicel Grand Prix. What is that experience like, which is something new, innovative for Jamaican track and field?
That is teaching me a lot, because the team at Sol Rixon, Bruce James, Maurice Wilson, Valerita Robertson, we have some of the best minds in different fields that are working on this mega instrument that we're trying to push for Jamaica track and field and sports in general, because there are plans afoot for, you know, expansion with the Sol Rixon team. And I get to learn from these people. I mean, I'm the youngest of the team, obviously, by 10-20 years. You know, I'm the youngest of the team, so I sit at the feet of greatness. These people have gone through their different storms. They've gone through their different hills, their different valleys. And I'm learning from that. I'm learning what mistakes not to make. I'm learning what not to do. I'm learning what to do to make myself successful. So, you know, especially Maurice Wilson, I remember watching him as a young athlete. He was a coach at Homewood at the time. And now to be sitting right next to him in a board meeting, you know, it's almost surreal because I'm like, all right. Because I don't tell him this all the time, you know, but sometimes I'm like, I'm sitting next to Maurice Wilson, you know, head coach at Jamaica. And Bruce James is there, you know, Ricky Martin, those guys, they are experts in their field. And I'm just gathering all this information. I don't care, you know, this is where I'm learning. I'm learning to be a meet manager. I'm learning to be a team manager. I'm learning to be an assistant director. I'm learning these things from these older people. And one thing I can say is that I'm not afraid. And I think fear cripples a lot of us when we go into situations like that, because you're 28 years old and you're talking to the director who's almost 50. You know, you try to speak with a certain level of respect and that's there, but they give me the leeway to speak my mind. And I think this team has really solidified for me in my mind what I want to do in the future, because they give me the freedom to just run. You know, they say if you have an idea, you come with it. Whatever it is, you come with it. Sometimes they don't accept it, but that's fine. I mean, I say sometimes, I mean 7 out of 10 times they say no, extra, that's not gonna work. But the 3 times that they say yes, it gives me encouragement to say, you know what, something is working. So I'm thankful for that team of people who are introducing me to a different side of, you know, the management side. I'm learning about accounting through Dwight Sulph and all those guys. So it's just a mixture of everything. I mean, it's hard to take on sometimes, but, you know, I carry a recorder to the meetings. So I record and then I listen over, because sometimes in meetings, things go over your head because you don't know some of the jargons and news. So I go back and I listen to something and I say, you know what, I don't know what that means. So I take up my phone and I'll text coach there. Coach, I heard this X, Y. What do you mean by that? And him that call me, because him don't like send WhatsApp messages. Him call me and say, boy, X doll, I'm busy, you know. Talk to me later in the week. And if I call him later in the week, he has time and we sit and talk about it. So it's just me collecting all this information, all this knowledge from everybody that I meet, you know.
Extra, if there is a youngster listening or one that you're mentoring, what advice would you give that young athlete, especially the ones you mentor, about college athletics and sports?
Know who you are. It's simple as it sounds, but you have to know who you are. You have to know what exactly you want to accomplish and be prepared to not accomplish it. You know, that's what I tell the youngsters. Be prepared to have a goal and lose that goal, or lose in the attempt to get that goal, because losing is good. Losing prepares you for winning. And I say this because I've lost a lot. I've lost a lot physically, I've lost a lot emotionally, I've lost a lot. But it's in losing is when I really begun to appreciate my journey, because we're not all on the same journey. I mean, I know the destination, we all know the destination, but the journey to get there is different for everyone. You know, some people have 2 kids, some people have 1, some have none. The journey is different, destination remains the same. So for the young athletes who will listen to this podcast, be encouraged, because some days, and I say this all the time, you know, the darkest part of the night is just before the day lights, you know, and I'm living in my daylight now. I've gone through some really dark times, especially in the past 3 years. I've gone through some dark moments where, if I tell you, you'd be surprised. You know, a lot of people who are close to me, my family, they know exactly what I've gone through in the past 3 years. So to see where I am now, it's at the end of the darkness, stepping into that light. And I was afraid in the darkness. I was afraid. Because I say, you know what, I can't manage this. But for those who will listen, you can. At the end, things will be fine. And if you feel like you're at the end or things aren't fine, then you're not at the end. You just have to keep going. You have to keep pushing. You have to stay encouraged and reach out. Because that's one thing I failed to do when I was in college. I didn't reach out to anybody. I didn't feel like I needed to talk to anybody. I mean, I talked to Coach Riley and he'd say, all right, I'm just telling him. I say, yeah, man, I'm all right. And then that's it. Be honest about who you are and what you want to accomplish, and be honest with the people around you, because they're there to help you. As much as you want to feel like you're a big man, there are people who are there to help you. You just have to find them.
Really good. Thank you very much to Dwayne, XL Dwayne. Really appreciate that, being candid, being open with us. And we appreciate all of those kind words. Thanks for joining us on this week's episode of The Drive Phase. Make sure to subscribe to the show on iTunes or use our RSS feed so you'll never miss an episode. Remember, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes or simply tell a friend about the show so that they too can spread the word. Feel free to send comments or questions about this episode or any other episode. And you can send these to our email address at thedrivephase@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter, TheDriveFaseJA, and on Facebook, TheDriveFase. Or TDP is the hashtag for updates on all things The Drive Phase. Until next time, I'm Dalton Myers. See you then.